Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
Welcome to this KQED Public Radio Public Affairs Special. I'm Scott Schaefer. On August 27, 2013, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View presented America's Cup Comes to San Francisco, Technology Under Sail. The program featured a distinguished panel of experts to discuss some of the most sophisticated technology ever deployed in both America's Cup racing and the televised coverage of the race itself. Here to introduce the program is John Holler, President and CEO of the Computer History Museum.
The Oracle Team USA trimaran that won the 33rd America's Cup off the coast of Spain in 2010 was the fastest boat ever to run the race. But for team founder Larry Ellison, also, of course, Oracle's chairman, a bigger challenge lay ahead. And so when his team prepared to defend the cup this summer in San Francisco Bay, Ellison proposed that the competitors build and sail an entirely new kind of boat, a catamaran with a 72-foot wing sail, one of the most extraordinary designs in the history of sailing. These boats represent breakthroughs in technology in almost every respect, from the materials they're made of, to the wing design, to the hydrofoil sailing techniques they enable, and the high-tech gear on board. They move at speeds approaching 50 miles an hour. And this summer, in the ever-changing conditions of the bay, they have occasionally proven to be as treacherous as they are beautiful. The coverage of the race has been as technically marvelous as the sailing, in large part because of a new technology called Liveline, which overlays the race course with an array of real-time graphics. It's a little like NASCAR, speed skating, and world-class sailing all rolled into one. With us tonight are three members of the team responsible for these innovations. Ian Burns, also known as Fresh, has been competing in the America's Cup since 1987 when he worked for the Australian defender Kookaburra. He was a founding member of the BMW Oracle Racing Team in 2001 as navigator, and he's one of the nine original members still with that team. He's a mechanical engineer by training, and as head of performance for Oracle Team USA, he is now instrumental in refining what these massive catamarans can do on the water. There are 30 people on the design and performance team alone. Matt Mason sails under Skippy Jimmy Spittle as one of four grinders on Oracle Team USA. This is his fifth America's Cup campaign. He won it in 1995 with New Zealand and successfully defended it in 2000. He also helped build New Zealand's yachts in those years. And he won the Cup a third time in 2010 as a member of the BMW Oracle Racing Team. Finally, Stan Honey, the four-time Emmy-winning technologist whose creativity has completely changed the face of televised sport, baseball, football, NASCAR racing, the Olympics, and more, as we'll learn tonight. And in the last year, the Liveline technology he invented has brought sailing to life on television and the internet in an entirely new and amazing way. Stan is not only, among other things, an IEEE fellow, he is a world-class sailor. In 2010, he was the navigator aboard Grouparama 3, which sailed nonstop around the world in a little more than 58 days, set the world record, and won the Jules Verne Trophy. Please join me in welcoming Stan, Ian, and Matt.
Okay.
So glad to have you here. So, Matt, you were out on the water today. How was it?
Yeah, we had a pretty good day today. Well, in all honesty, it didn't finish that well, but another good day on the water for us. Every day is a good day. We just had one boat out today. We're counting down the days, and we're running out of days sailing. So, good day. Had a little mishap at the end of the day, but that happens.
Is every day different? Can you predict at all what's going to happen from day to day?
Well, you can never predict out there on the water, and especially in these things, you know.
Yeah.
there's a lot of this going on, we predict obviously the weather. You can't predict things out of your control, but everything's been going pretty well for us in the last couple of months. We've been making some big steps, and we've really been pushing our two-boat program recently over the last month. And being able to sail our two boats together has been going really well for us.
Ian, since we're talking about technology under sail tonight, talk a little bit about these boats, the technology behind them, and what makes them different from any boats that have ever been raced like this.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting. Matt always underplays a little bit the requirements on these boats, but these boats are incredibly fast and incredibly powerful, and the guys that sail upon them are really a new generation of sailors. Previous cups, you know, they're guys who are 50 years old would sail on the boat, and they'd be quite often big, strong guys, and sometimes not, but they'd have long careers and they sail and they do relatively sedentary jobs on the old monohulls. On these boats, a new generation of sailors are really fit, agile guys who've got great aerobic capacity that can work hard for 30 minutes straight. But not only are they putting in the horsepower like Matty does on the winch handles to power all of the hydraulics and sails, but they also are driving all of the electronic controls that connect the winches in a certain pattern to drive one of the winches, change the hydraulics, move the dagger boards, change a number of the hydraulic rams on. They're doing all of this while they're sailing, while they're grinding the winch handles, also being sprayed by basically a fire hose continuously over the top of what they're doing. And this is all on San Francisco Bay on a short course where things change every few seconds. And so it's sort of a little understatement of Matt's, I guess, just to say that we had a pretty good day. I mean, it was a big challenge, as they always are out there. And, you know, the guys really did a great job as usual. It's good.
I sort of let that part about being 50 years old and trying to sail go. We'll just kind of let that we'll let that remark just go, you know, completely unremarked there. What is it about the development of these boats that has sort of changed the course of racing history? Can you talk a little bit about what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of you guys who are sailors will know all of this, but on all the monohulls, generally they're ballasted with lead, which means you're really carrying around a huge amount of weight in the boats just to keep the boat stable and upright so it doesn't roll over against the forces of the wind. And the monohulls are all pretty much like that. In general, the large monohulls we've always raced in the Cup, these boats have no ballast. They're purely generating stability because they're very wide, but the hulls are very slender, which means they're incredibly efficient. And it's all about the efficiency of these boats because they're so powerful, so lightweight. The boats only weigh 6 tons for a 72-foot yacht, but they have the stability of probably equivalent yacht that weighs 20 or 30 tons. So they are very powerful, very, very low drag. And to couple all of that efficiency and power, you need to have a wing sail, which is a whole new level of technology for this America's Cup, for fleet racing or for a whole fleet of boats, to have a wing sail. Once again, much more efficient than an old soft sail, a fabric sail that we've used in all the cups up until now.
So, Matt, the grinder, as Ian was talking about, you guys are the ones with the handles in your hands and you're just working constantly during a sail. Now, on a conventional boat, you'd be doing something entirely different from what you're doing on this boat. Can you talk about the role of a grinder before and a grinder now?
Yeah, on the bigger boats, they have grinders as well, pedestals we call them. They would just be running the winches to sheet the sails. We still have to do that. The wing has a sheet on it, and the little front sail has a sheet, jib sheets on it as well. So we're still sheeting the sails, but we're also, the grinders are also, a lot of the systems, or, you know, the majority of the systems on the boat are run by hydraulics. So it's, the rule doesn't allow any power, so you've got to, it's all manually created by the pedestal being turned. So you're either creating power for a winch or you're moving oil to run the hydraulic system. Yeah, it probably would have been hard to have picked up on this on the video there, but the boat on each hull has 4 cockpits, individual cockpits, and each one of those cockpits there's a pedestal, and 2 guys is on either side of that pedestal, and they grind. 2 guys on a pedestal, they grind together. And they can go in and out of hydraulics or sheets or do a combination of different things.
And how do you know on the boat when it's time to do what you do and when it's time to let up?
Well, that's just part of learning how to sail these boats, and every manoeuvre is different. And, you know, that's been a big learning curve for us, and we're just getting into our race side. We've been sort of pushing the boats around the race course for the last 6 weeks now, and it's really no different to figuring out how you do a play on the football field and getting it right and nailing it. It's all similar. You just have to video and analyse all your manoeuvres, and practice makes perfect.
Yeah. We also have a intercom system on the boat where the everybody can hear the helmsman and a few other guys as well, so that it's somewhat coordinated by our helmsman, Jimmy Spithill, making the commands, counting down until a manoeuvre occurs so that all the moves get done. But it's repeated and repeated over and over so the guys can do it no matter what the situation and the pressure of the racing moment. Mm.
For the crew work side of it, we have four GoPros over the boat, and then our coach, he synchronises that at the end of each day, and in our sailing room we have four big screens and they're all synchronised, and we debrief and hash it out and go out the next day and making steps every day.
I want to talk about the after party, if you will, where you guys do all this work in just a minute, but let me get you in here, Stan, because you've got a pretty exceptional challenge, right? And you're a world-class sailor in your own right. What is it to try to keep up with the way these races unfold from the coverage that you have to do?
The key thing with the TV is to tell the story of the race so that the sports fans who aren't yet sailing fans can understand, the nature of the competition, the ways the different teams are, have different strengths than one another. And then the approach that we've taken, to this sport is to just make a ton of measurements. We know where every boat is, every mark is within a couple of centimeters. And then to, illustrate by inserting graphics into the live video, illustrate the important things about the event that are otherwise hard to see.
I want to show everyone here a little bit of the technology that you've been responsible for before and what you're doing now with the America's Cup. So we have some slides. John, if you could bring those pictures up. Talk about this one first.
This one was not well received. this is the hockey puck, the Fox Tracks hockey puck. I had co-founded with a colleague, Ken Melnes, a company called ETAC, which is a pioneered vehicle navigation and rotating maps, and ended up selling that to Rupert Murdoch. So I ended up as a head of technology for a media company, which I'd never expected. I got to know David Hill, who was then starting Fox Sports, and would have periodic conversations with David Hill every week or so. And he asked me to always talk about ways in which technology could affect the televising of sports. So on one of these lunches, I told him that it was just becoming computationally feasible to do graphic insertions in live video that were properly registered into the real world. So you could, for example, put in a fake billboard. David told me something I was to hear many times over the years from David, that it was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard. But he said, if you could put stuff into live video of the real world that was accurately positioned in the real world, could you do something useful, like show something that's hard to see and important? And his example was, could you track and highlight the hockey puck? And in those days, it was hard to see the puck because it was standard definition. I told David that, it was possible, and the group of guys I'd worked with at SRI International, nearby, right here in Menlo Park, we'd tracked things that were much tougher, but that he couldn't afford it. He accurately explained to me that I didn't know anything about the economics of sports broadcast. So he asked me to write him a memo telling him what it would cost, and so I spent a week and made an estimate and sent David a memo. And then not 10 minutes later, Rupert Murdoch called up and said, I understand you can track and highlight a hockey puck in 2 years for $2 million. And I said, yeah, and he said, do it. That's where this started. So it was introduced. We started in 94. It actually started very near here. There's an SGI building a couple buildings down. And we kicked off a meeting with a couple people that are here today, Alan Trimble and Tim Heidman, who were key team members. We started in 94, and it was introduced in the All-Star Game in 96. And David Hill accurately predicted that the diehard hockey fans would hate it, but heck, they're diehard fans, they're going to watch anyway.
Right.
And they did hate it, but it did result in the best rating hockey had ever had at that point. So it was successful in that respect.
Is this the kind of... Yeah, please, go ahead. That's Is this the kind of thing only a non-hockey fan would ask somebody to do?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
I think there was only one play that the hockey fans appreciated, which was a goal was scored by a shot ricocheting off the back of another hockey player. And the fans had to admit that they never would have known that's how the puck got into the goal had it not been for the Fox Track system. But other than that, they were uniformly opposed to it.
So let's go to the next innovation, which is one we can all appreciate. This is the yellow line showing you where the first down is on the football field. So talk a little bit about this one.
Yeah, this one was far more popular. And it was more challenging in a couple of interesting ways. The puck, the trail of the puck, we just keyed it on top of everything. The challenge for this, and in fact, one of the guys here, Tim Heidman, thought it could never be done. But the challenge for this was to be able to compute where the yellow line should appear, but then look at the color of every pixel, decide which pixels corresponded to the mud or the grass, and which pixels corresponded, by virtue of being a different color,
every
to the athletes.
Pixel.
And so then we would draw around the athletes. And so by holding that yellow line fixed relative to the view of the real world, and by drawing around the athletes, we would create the illusion that it was on the ground. It worked very well, and it was very successful. We introduced it with ESPN in the fall of 98, and it very quickly rolled out to all televised football games.
You told me that when you first started putting the yellow line on the football field, your team had to drive an 18-wheeler loaded with high-end workstations into the production area just to generate the yellow line. Is that what computing was like back in those days?
The original hockey puck, the puck truck as we called it, the puck truck was also used for the first yellow line. It was a 50-foot production truck with SGI impacts, and it was a major drama at every game to reseat the boards and get those computers running again.
Now let's look at the next one. This is the famous K zone in baseball. It's done in an even more amazing way today, but talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, this was actually the idea for this came from Jed Drake from ESPN. And we never would have sold it, never would have taken on this project had it not been for Alan Trimble, who's here tonight, who Jed sent him to Sport Vision, which is the company that I spun out from News Corp to found, whose engineering offices are now next door, mm-hmm. as it turns out. Jed Drake sent Alan Trimble to Sport Vision to visit. And Alan went back and told Jed, well, they're going to make it work. Alan didn't explain to Jed how, but he did explain that we would eventually make it work. So the question was whether Jed got the Emmy or somebody else. So Jed decided to take on the project. So it was the K-Zone. We tracked the baseball to within a centimeter for most of its flight from the pitcher to the plate. We superimposed the strike zone, above the plate, show the crosshair where the ball either goes through the strike zone or misses. And this was introduced in about 2000.
And what did the umpires' union think about this?
It was fascinating. The umpires at first were incredibly opposed to it and hated it, but within 2 weeks, the umpires became huge advocates and our biggest supporters because the K-Zone showed something that surprised everybody. They showed everybody that the umpires were doing a much better job than anybody could have imagined. Because with the exception of a few ESPN broadcasts, the center field camera wasn't exactly in line. And so there was a distortion there in perspective. And the umpires were, in fact, doing a much better job. And so very quickly after that, Major League Baseball worked with Sport Vision to instrument all ballparks. And even on those games where a system like this isn't being used, the baseball is still tracked, and the umpires in Major League Baseball use that data to help rate the performance of the umpires.
It's not at all unlike what you guys were talking about using data after the fact to evaluate your performance. It's a world of big data, right?
Yeah.
So let's look at the last one. This is very familiar to us all because it's the Olympic
speed skating rink where you can clearly see who's skating for which nation.
Yeah, this was actually the principal objective of the system we did for the Olympics were the ones that many of you have seen where you have a line and it moves at the world record pace or the pace of the fastest athlete in the previous heat. Kind of as an add-on, we were asked to identify the nationality of the athletes, you know, by superimposing national flags. And this was a particularly funny circumstance because we were criticized for having tripped the Canadian.
Well, there, and there's photographic evidence that you did. So for those of you who didn't know Stan and the work that he's done, it's been epic. If you're a sports fan, it's completely changed the experience of watching sport on television. And if you're not, I think it probably draws you in a way that unaided sports broadcasting might not. But now you're taking on one of the toughest assignments ever. And I'd like for you to just tell the story about how you got involved with trying to change the viewing experience of the America's Cup.
You know, I've kind of had parallel careers. One as, you know, fairly conventional career in technology, working for SRI, founding the vehicle navigation company ETAC, ending up as head of technology for News Corp, spinning off my group to start Sport Vision, which is virtually next door. And then, but in parallel to that, I had another career that I mostly took on in, you know, bits of and pieces of time, certainly all of my vacation, but also good chunks of leave without pay. And that was a career as a professional navigator in sailing. And as a professional navigator in sailing, I navigated the round the world record and navigated and won the Volvo Ocean Race. But I also had the opportunity to navigate yachts for a number of owners, such as Larry Ellison and Sayonara, Steve Fawcett, Roy Disney, Richard Branson. And in 95 through about 97, I was navigating Sayonara, and this was the same period where we were introducing the and working on the puck and the first down line. And during the time I was navigating Sayonara, I mentioned to Larry, because he's certainly a technologist and very, you know, very smart guy. And so he very quickly understood what we were doing in terms of what's now called augmented reality. And I mentioned that the sports that benefit from this, these systems where you can insert graphics into the real world are those sports where there's something important to the sport that's hard to see. The first down line's a great example. The first down line is the objective of almost every play, and yet you can't see it when the camera zooms in and you can no longer see the chain gang. The strike zone is certainly important in baseball, you know, to every pitch. And in sailing, I observed to Larry that there's lots of things in sailing that are important to the sport and hard to see, you know, such as the, you know, who's ahead, the 100-meter lines, the lay lines, you know, where the marks are. And so I mentioned that, you know, to Larry, and that was in, again, probably 96. And then to my astonishment, when I was navigating the round-the-world record for the French in 2010, there was an interview with Larry in Fortune magazine, and Larry mentioned that when asked what is he going to do with TV for the America's Cup, having won the America's Cup, he mentioned he was going to look up an old sailing colleague of his, you know, Stan Honey, and this is what we were going to do. And I was in the Southern Ocean at the time, so it was quite something to read that, because you never know what you're going to do next in life, but in this case, I did.
Yeah. And with Rupert Murdoch and Larry Ellison, you've worked for a couple of guys who can make it happen once they set their minds to it. That's very interesting.
And so when I finally got in from that trip, on my message machine was the message from Fresh saying, let's talk.
Yeah. Now, did you have an idea at that point what the vision was for changing the experience of sailing as a viewer?
We certainly knew what was needed, if you know what I mean. It's quite often expert sailors, whilst watching sailing races, don't really know who's winning, believe it or not. You know, from just seeing the two boats sailing together, it's quite hard. And it's well known what was needed, but there's only really one person in the world that we know of capable of providing what Stan's done. The Stan, it takes an incredible blend of technology from the capture of visual images and the technology of positioning and many other things to integrate that all together. And Stan had done it before, but sailing presented some unique challenges that the other things that you've seen him do didn't present, one of which is the fact that the whole frame, everything is moving. There's nothing anchored to the ground at all in those pictures, the marks, the boats, the helicopter taking the pictures, everything's moving.
So we do have about 45 seconds of a very long segment of video that begins to illustrate what you have done. Let's just look at that, and maybe you can talk us through exactly how it works.
So this is a match racing start. You need to see where the entry lines are, the port and starboard, and then, of course, the primary entry line, and then you see the start line up near the center top. So it's imagine looking at that frame without the graphics. It'd be very difficult to interpret. There's the starting line. The starting line changes color at the instant of the start. So that line will change from red to white at the instant of the start. You can see the boats identified with the labels off the tops of their masts. The yellow line is the lay line. That's the point at which a boat can reach the next mark without having to tack or jibe. And then you may have seen those white lines that are parallel. Those are the 100-meter lines. But the interesting thing about those 100-meter lines is that the combination of those lines in conjunction with the boundaries around the course allow almost any sports fan who's seen American football to very quickly interpret who's ahead. And the funny thing happens, which is normally in sailing, it's difficult to explain to a non-sailor the fact that the boats, you know, are sailing in different directions. So people will say, wait a minute, it's a race. Why are the boats all going different ways? But if you show, you know, where the mark is and you show those 100-meter lines and you show the boundaries and people get it, they say, okay, that's a field of play, that's a pitch, they're trying to go that way. And then they very quickly learn for themselves that you can't go straight at it. You can go one way or the other, and you tack, and eventually you get to the mark, and they very quickly sort of embrace the tactics of getting up the beat. The other interesting thing about those 100-meter lines is it's interesting to note that the distance between each of those lines is approximately a football field. So that's the other difficulty of televising sailing, which is it's a very large field to play.
Mm-hmm. Talk for a minute about the technology that you've had to invent in order to essentially create multiple football fields on San Francisco Bay.
Well, first I'll comment that it takes a team.
Sure.
And one of the things I'm most proud of, you know, in my career, you know, starting at SRI, is the fact that I've been able to work with fabulous folks, and I've been able to con them into helping me with future projects. And so I've had the wonderful experience of being able to work with many of the same people for the last 30 years. I think that's the reason why, you know, we as a group have managed to, you know, do a number of these projects that haven't been done before, because we have the confidence, you know, working with one another and the, you know, the breadth of skills. The thing about sailing that was so tricky is that all the other sports that we've talked about, whether it's football, baseball, you know, a system we did for NASCAR where we tracked, you know, all the race cars, all of those systems have cameras that are mounted on tripods. So they can pan and tilt, but it's relatively easy to measure the angle of the camera with optical encoders relative to the tripod, and it's relatively easy to use the camera itself as a theodolite to measure its own position, you know, surveying itself in. The thing about sailing that's so difficult is the camera's in a helicopter. The helicopter's, you know, weaving all around in the sky, and it's a long way away from the field of play. And then everything else is moving. The marks are moving, the sailboats are moving. So it's really, you know, a measurement challenge. So we have to measure the location of each of the sailboats to within 2 centimeters and its orientation to a tenth of a degree. And then we have to measure the position of the helicopter to 2 centimeters. And its orientation to a hundredth of a degree. And the reason we need the helicopter angle so accurately is it's, you know, 1,000 feet away from the field of play, and if we have its angle wrong, the graphics will swim around in the video of the real world. And then we need to measure the camera on the helicopter and its angle relative to the helicopter to a hundredth of a degree. Then we compute the point of view of the camera and the field of the view of the camera, compute the correspondence between every pixel and the appropriate place in the real world. Then Alan Trimble, who's here today, figures out what's important to the story.
Yeah.
So what graphics do we need to show? And then he presses the appropriate buttons, and then those graphics are displayed superimposed in that helicopter video just at the time the commentator is saying, let's go back and look at the Italian
boat.
That's
amazing. Now, we talked a minute, I mean, that's phenomenal. We talked a minute ago about the puck truck and what it took 20 years ago to put the yellow line on the football field. What kind of technology are you using today to do all that?
We're using, you know, high-powered sort of quad-core PCs, and we tend to use the most powerful, you know, PCs we can conveniently buy, and we tend to run them just up at their capability. And if we get too aggressive about the graphics, we have a problem and we have to back off a little bit. But we're basically running at the top edge of the most powerful, reasonably available PCs.
So anything we could go out and buy today at Best Buy, or not exactly? Not far from it.
Not far from it, but yeah. Basically these are, you know, purpose-built, rack-mounted, yeah. You know, powerful yeah. computers.
Still, it's not a truck.
Yeah, with NVIDIA cards, but it's not a truck.
Right.
What we actually do now, because the America's Cup World Series has moved around the world, is the entire TV compound is packaged up in 20 international shipping containers. And the project, you know, our project of doing the live line, the tracking, and we also support the umpiring and the race management, that all fits in about 2.5 containers.
So, Ian, the kind of technology that Stan is talking about that makes these amazing pictures possible is also producing data for you guys. I mean, it's not. I'm not talking about the same platform. I'm talking about what you're relying on to improve the performance of the boat, to measure the performance and evaluate it. Can you talk a little bit about this sea of data that you guys are collecting on every boat and what you're trying to extract from that?
Yeah, I mean, the boats are pretty technical. On my first America's Cup in 1984 and 85, we were sort of the first boat to have a computer on board. And it was a big deal. It was sort of an old Microvax, I think it was, and it was about this big, and it had a huge bank of batteries to run it. And now we have, if you count the tablets that we display all the data on for the crew, we probably have about 50 computers on the boat, little computers, larger computers. But the technology of data collection is pretty much the same. What's changed dramatically over the period of time is the wealth of data collection methods around. The actual sensors are relatively cheap and highly accurate. These things have sort of blossomed out. So we get sort of like a doubling or a quadrupling of the number of sensors every America's Cup. Last Cup we had about 100. This Cup we have about 400 sensors on the boat. And they range from, say, a fiber optic gyro inertial motion system, which will tell you your accuracy. Stan uses a very similar thing in the helicopter. We have two of those, one on the boat and one on the wing, to actually tell which way everything's oriented relative to the world. And these things generate a huge amount of accurate data, but that's just one of many sensors. We have fiber optic strain gauges. We have pressure sensors in the hydraulics. We have pressure sensors that measure the pressure of the wind on the wing. We have all sorts of instrumentation that just spews data to us at a relatively slow rate of 10 hertz for data collection. But on a big sailing boat, that's actually just about fast enough. And
you're also measuring the physiology of the sailors themselves, right?
We have heart rate monitors and also power measurements of what the guys output, so we can check in on the sailor. One of the rarest commodities on the boat is enough horsepower to actually do anything on the boat. So as the guys are working and getting tired, you can see the performance of the boat decrease in the manoeuvres as the guys get more and more tired. And usually the best jibe of the day is the first one, and the worst one is the last jibe as the guys get tired. We monitor all of that. Look at the performance of the guys across the actual race course from the start of the race to the finish. And it's really interesting to see the different physiological types of grinders and how each one performs at the start and end of the races.
How do you feel about that, Matt?
Tired. As I'm nodding off. as Fresh says, the boats are incredibly demanding. One of the things we've learned is the races are only 30 minutes, but on any one day that we're out testing, we can spend 4 or 5 hours out there. And on a big day when it's sort of around 20 knot day, we're burning between 5,000 and 6,000 calories, which is pretty...
On a training day.
Yeah.
6,000 calories a day.
Very, very physical.
That's amazing. Now, how is your strategy and the strategy of everybody that you work with on the team affected by the things that you're learning? And what changes in your performance are you trying to achieve according to all of this information that you're getting and the debriefing you're doing with the team?
Well, I guess on any one day, we have our specific days. We can have a day where, we could call it a full-on testing day where we have a list of objectives that we want to tick off. Or then another day could be just a sole race day where we're out banging the corners and going around the course. But on any one of those days, we have all this information coming in from off the boat, and then we have to put it all together and then coincide the feedback from the sailing team. So every day we have a debrief after sailing, get the feedback from the sailors on, we call it how it felt on board and what the, whether it's a dagger board or a new rudder or a new wing angle and talk about that, and then just we get Fresh's performance report and put it all together and then make the decisions that way.
Mm-hmm. To give you an idea, I mean, we've identified in a jibe about 12 actions that have a significant impact on how good a jibe is. A jibe's a manoeuvre we do where we change from one tack to the other, passing away from the wind, and it's what the boats do when they're flying at high speed. There's about 12 things that need to be done well or perfectly to get a perfect jibe. Some of them require the actions of the guys controlling the hydro surfaces that actually can control the orientation of the boat. The average human response time is about 50 milliseconds, and there's a window of about 70 to 80 that these things have to be done in to get a perfect response to the boat. And our coaches are on the boats watching this on the chase boats following the yachts. They're watching how the guys are doing, what angle these surfaces are at, and how they're being pressed at the right time. And that's the sort of, level of technology where we're collecting the data, looking at the data, and then feeding it back to the sailors as either on the water or off the water.
And are you looking at this in real time? Can you see all of this happening as it happens?
Yeah, we do. We have a performance boat which has got usually 3, 4, or 5 technicians, myself, a number of guys who run the systems instrumentation, and also guys who analyse sails and crew performance. They're all on this boat together, and we're watching the boat real-time. The structures guys will be watching the strain on the dagger boards or the strain in the wing. The trainers will be watching the heart rates of the guys. All these different areas are being studied real-time, plus we beam the data back to shore, and so that guys on shore in the design office, for example, can see what the boat's doing and take note of the performance of the boat and see how it's going.
So those of us who are watching will hear the commentators say, maybe 10 seconds later, "Wow, that looked like a really good jibe. They really did a nice job." And you've known it for ages, right? Because
we've known it for 8 seconds.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you talked about how this influences your coverage of the race, Dan. So are you getting it in real time and you're able to evaluate it and then say to somebody in his earpiece, they really nailed that turn?
We get quite a bit of information in real time. We do get the audio off the boat, which is mostly safe to use on air. And we have our own sensors where we have very accurate measurements of the boat's attitude and its location. And obviously we can compute its speed and accelerations and so forth. We get some data from the team's instruments themselves, but we're very careful with that data that it doesn't go out and so other teams can't get it. So we make almost no use of that because we're so careful taking care of that data. And then we compute a lot of things based on the data, such as the tacking loss, the jibing loss, obviously the maximum speeds. And then we make that information available for the producer and the director to choose from and the commentators to tell that story on air.
And then, Matt, you know at the moment whether it's a good jibe or not. Can you feel during the race, that was a great maneuver for us, or maybe it wasn't, and then you go back and look at the data?
Oh, yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah.
It's very obvious, the good and the bad. And we have the basic numbers on board as well. You know, the big one's the boat speed number that you watch. So it's quite hard for anyone on board to actually be focusing on that through a manoeuvre. But the tactician will quite often say that was a pretty nice jibe. You know, low bottom speed. But you feel the difference. Very easy to tell.
And for both of you, Ian and Stan, has there ever been a sport, or in this case, just the America's Cup of Racing, where the data that was driving the boat was so closely integrated with the data you're getting and doing the coverage that it all seems to be moving kind of seamlessly together?
It's interesting. You know, F1 makes, extensive use of data off of the cars, but it's not nearly as closely integrated with the broadcast as I think we do in sailing. The other thing we do in sailing, which is, I think, remarkable for a sport, is the extent to which the data is used for the officiating and the management of the event itself.
Now talk about that, because this time the claim of a foul, the evaluation by the officials, and the ruling is occurring in real time at an unbelievably real speed. Can you talk about why that's happening now?
Well, first, it's extraordinary that it is happening, and it's especially extraordinary that it's happening with the America's Cup, because the America's Cup, in many ways, is the oldest continuously competed for trophy in all of sport, and so you'd expect it to be kind of behind the times somehow, but yet the America's Cup is more aggressive in its use of technology in the management of the event and the officiating of the event than any other sport. So, for example, in baseball and football, there's a lot of data. But yet in baseball, because of the long tradition of baseball and the importance of that tradition, the strikes and balls are still called by the officials, even though exists very good data about the location of the ball. And, of course, the tradition is the batter's playing both against the pitcher and the official. But in sailing, the interesting thing about it is that the America's Cup has chosen to use this data in real time for the initial call, so that the umpiring of the America's Cup takes place in part on the water, but also it takes part in part on the booth. And the way the professional umpires have split it up is very sensible. All of the umpire calls that are based on measurements and fact alone are made in the booth, based on these measurements. So if the call has to do with a boundary violation, or was there an overlap between two boats at the instant of zone entry, or was a boat OCS, or which means on the course side of the starting line at the time the clock got to zero, those calls are all made in the booth based on measurements. Whereas there's other subjective calls that are made on the water, such as did a boat have an opportunity to keep clear? Could that boat have avoided that collision? Those calls have to be made by sailors on the water who are umpires and who are seeing what's actually going on and can see the entire environment. But it is remarkable to me how aggressive the America's Cup has been in using this data.
Has this affected your strategy at all, or the team strategy, Ian, as you?
We have an unusual position. America's Cup racing, there's a bunch of challenges, in this case three, but the defender's somewhat isolated and doesn't get to race against or even have a performance check-in with the challengers. But with Stan's accurate coverage and the publication of that data, we're able to collect some very accurate information about how the challengers are going. And lucky for us, we don't publish our data, and so they're not so aware of how we are. So it's actually the reverse of what usually happens. But in this case, we've actually managed to collect quite a lot of good information about the Kiwis and the Italians and Artemis' performance, which puts us in a pretty good situation for the first time ever in America's Cup, where we have a good picture of their performance.
Thus proving what I've always heard about sailors, which is they just want a slightly unfair advantage. So let me ask you about, I want to get back to the way these boats sail and this popping up out of the water and sailing on foils. Was this a discovery? Did a boat suddenly pop out of the water one day and everybody was thinking, holy cow, we can fly? Or was it part of the design ethic from the beginning?
It's a good question. The original class rule, which I was involved in drafting, never envisaged the boats flying like they do. And it's so at the first start of this class of boats, which was back in 2010, I think, there was no idea of the boats flying. Very quickly, the Kiwi team came to the conclusion that it would be possible to fly the boat at some stage. They were mainly imagining going around the top mark, and this is where you're in a lot of danger of nosediving. And their belief was if you came around it in the water that you probably would nosedive, and by having foils and controlling the boat, you'd be able to fly. They were right, and they spent a fair bit of time developing it. And the other teams that were aware of this, thinking about it, planning it, but saw the Kiwis doing it and got right on board with it and headed down that path. And, you know, the difference is something in the order of 10 or 15% of the drag of the boat, and the speeds are about that different too. So if you're not flying, it's about 10 or 15% slower, which is dramatic on the water. Some of the challenges of this are interesting because sailing prior had generally been confined to being on the surface of the water, which made it a two-dimensional problem, which yacht designers and yachting technologists had got a good handle on. They understood all the forces and the boat getting forces sideways and fore and aft and the drag and the thrust. But the moment you put the third dimension, the Z dimension, suddenly started to play, a lot of the guys that were well-known and established yacht designers were struggling with what was going to make these boats fly and fly safely and stably. And one of the great challenges of the boats is the stability of flight. And you'll see sometimes all of the boats, while they're flying fast, will get some sort of hobby horsing, we call it, where they'll go up and down. And it's where they're on the verge of stability. And they, if you look in aerodynamic terms, the boats are unstable. But there's sort of a three areas of stability in aircraft, which is unstable and unflyable. And then there's partially stable, where input control can actually keep the plane straight. But if you let go of the stick, the plane will become unstable. And this is the area that the America's Cup boats dwell. And they range in stability. And the stability makes it easy to do manoeuvres and easy to sail. But in general, it also makes the boat slower. And so there's a fair bit of energy that gets used up in keeping the boat stable automatically in that case. And so the sailors are always pushing for a less stable boat, which is faster. But on the other hand, the manoeuvres become slower. And also there's an element of danger of capsizing or an accident. So this is a problem that's new to sailing and new to us as sailors and designers. And it's proved challenging to everybody, but it's a great new problem. It's a great thing to be involved in.
What's the top speed you've seen your boat achieve?
We've had some 45s and or so, and I think
45 knots.
45 knots.
And that in miles per hour
that's
is
50 or nearly 50 miles per hour.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the Kiwis have even gone faster. I think they've been boasting about some 47s and 46 knots.
And Matt, when you know compared to you've been sailing at this level for over 25 years, or almost 25. What's it like to go that fast compared to the experience a normal sailor would have?
Yeah, well, now we're sort of, the 30, 35s you sort of take for granted, but when the boat gets up to 40, you're starting to know that it's hauling, and you know you get a bit of cavitation of the rudders. The rudders on the back have wings as well, which help stabilise the stern of the boat. And the windward one, the weather one, is normally just sitting on the surface, and that starts bouncing away. And when you get it doing 45, we actually, in our safety gear now, we have oxygen and we have harnesses. So when you get up over 40, 42 knots, most of the guys are normally clipping on, and you know you're doing it. The 35 knots, that's all day long now.
Wow.
35.
It's a ride in the park. One of the cavitation things that's quite interesting is that the boat in that instability starts going up and down, and the vertical forces on the foils change, and the thing will cavitate and then reattach as it does this, and that'll actually exacerbate the problem, and it starts getting into a rhythm and starts porpoising, and that's when you see some of the teams have big problems, usually having to stop.
So I've got a massive pile of questions here from the audience, and I can tell there's some real sailors out there too. So let me ask a couple of the sailing questions first. And this one is just basic, and anyone can appreciate that. How does the boat go faster than the wind? That's one someone's always wondering about.
I can start, and Stan will probably be able to correct me, but... Okay. When you're standing on the deck of a boat, you only feel the relative wind. And so it's a combination of both your speed, the speed of the current, which is quite significant in San Francisco Bay, and also the wind that you would feel if you were stationary. And so the actual stationary wind speed isn't actually particularly relevant to how fast you'll go. And, of course, the boat's motion being very, very fast in these boats means that the wind is always coming from in front of you. It's just like being in your car. When you stick your head out of the window at 60 miles an hour, you don't really know what the wind speed would be doing if you were stopped. And it's quite similar on the boats. The wind speed's always coming from in front. And upwind, we sail at about angles of about between 10 and 14 degrees apparent, which is very, very narrow apparent wind angle. For any of you guys who do any sailing, you know it's a pretty good angle. And even downwind, the wind's only 30 degrees or 20 degrees off the bow of the boat. So you're basically going upwind at a conventional angle for a conventional boat, but you're going downwind, and that's just the fact of relative wind that you're experiencing on the boat.
You've got all these critical strategic points. You've got the start, you've got smooth rounding of the marks, you've got your tacks and jibes. How did those change with a winged boat compared to a boat that has conventional sails?
Want
to talk about that, Matt? You've got a fixed wing. Of course, you're still trimming it and doing other things, but what's the main difference?
Well, yeah, the wing is basically a wing. You know, like it's been around for years and years on the planes. It's obviously sitting vertical. It has the main element, which is the front element, which has all the structure in it. And basically off the back, they're very light frames, which are called the flaps. There's four sections of those, and they're all split. So the wing gets cambered up through the main element, and then up the leech of the, which is like a normal sail. You can create the twist by easing the hydraulics and letting the wings twist open, and they're also designed to distort and twist, and that gives you your twist profile. Or you can bring the hydraulics on and shut it down. So in theory, it's actually very similar to a conventional sail in the way you control it by either, you know, you can the camber is similar to the outhaul, and shutting the leech down is like pulling on the main sheet. So in that respect, it's not that dissimilar, but they're all controlled by hydraulics, and then you just have a wing sheet that pulls the thing up and down. So they're very, very, very pretty easy to trim, but we have all our targets, and we monitor that daily on, and we're playing around with a lot with that recently.
Yeah. One of the things that is dramatically different from a soft sail is that when you're going straight into the wind, say during a manoeuvre, a jibe or a tack, the drag, for the actual drag from the wing, is very, very low, dramatically lower than a flapping sail, which is what you have on a conventional boat. And this is one of the things when we first announced multi-hull for the America's Cup, everyone said, oh, they'll never tack and they'll be slow and they won't be very good for the America's Cup. But it turns out because the drag's so low on the wings when they tack, the boats actually tack pretty efficiently, probably equivalent to the old monohulls as far as the distance that's lost in the tacks. And that's because the wing has very low drag. And the other good feature with that is when you let go of the sheet rope, the control rope that rotates the wing, and it just streams behind in the wind, the load on the boat goes down to almost zero immediately, which is a good thing compared to a sail, which can still have a lot of force even if it's completely released.
Now, one thing you talked about a minute ago is the very rapid deceleration and acceleration of these boats. So, Matt, what kind of challenge does that present to you when you're working on it?
Well, in the manoeuvres, if you're doing, you know, we're running mainly in the jibes is a tricky one, or in the tacks as well. The boat rotating and you're running on the trampoline. So going into a jibe, you're normally, you know, doing 30, probably, you know, the average speed downwind's probably 37, 38 knots. And you're up on the foils and the boat gets turned, and then half of the crew have to get to the other side as fast as they can on this trampoline. And, you know, for some reason one day we lost two guys over. But it's challenging. You can definitely, obviously the boat doesn't have lifelines. You can very easily go over the side,
get it wrong. Have you ever gone over?
No, we lost two guys on the same day for some reason.
Yeah, I think one other time we lost.
Yeah, them. You hit the deck. If you think it's going bad, you just hit the deck.
So talk for a minute about Jimmy Spittle as a skipper. Maybe you could talk about what it's like to sail for him and Maybe you guys could give me your impressions too. But talk, Matt, a little bit about Jimmy.
Yeah, Jimmy's he's a redhead, which sort of semi-explains his personality. He's a very, very talented skipper. You know, he's a young guy. He's the youngest skipper to win the America's Cup.
Yeah, won it at 33. Youngest
when we sailed on the big trimaran in Valencia in 2010. You know, he came out, his first America's Cup was in 2003 when he sailed with Sid Fisher in Auckland, and that was his introduction. Very talented, very motivated, one of the fittest guys on our team. He just loves his sport, and he takes any challenge on, and he'll be a great asset for us when we put the thing into the starting box for the first time.
Stan, what are your impressions? You've sailed a lot with a lot of skippers. You've seen a lot of skippers. What's your view of Jimmy?
He's very insightful about sailing techniques and others' tactics and strategy, and he's very scrappy. So I think he'll be he'll do a terrific job. Yeah.
Fresh?
Yeah, fearless is a word that immediately comes to mind. Yeah, I remember Rod Davis, a famous America's Cup guy with the Kiwi team, and he always used to say that all the coaches, the motivators say, you know, imagine yourself holding the cup up. And he said, I don't do that. I imagine myself failing, and that really spurs me on to do a better job to avoid that failure. Well, Jimmy, on the other hand, is completely fearless, and it never crosses his mind what might go wrong. It's always just pinpoint, laser point on the problem at hand. And the other talent that he's incredibly gifted at is the time on distance, the timing for a starting line. And you saw this in the old slower boats in the pre-starting, where he'd always get the timing perfect and the other boat would either be too early or too late behind him and he'd always be perfect. But on these boats, the real challenge is crossing the starting line. When you're doing 50 miles an hour, imagine trying to time yourself passing, say, a telegraph pole exactly on the second to cross on the starting line. And in general, Jimmy's starting times are a bracket of about a second, sometimes half a second over early, half a second behind, but he can judge it down to that level of maybe half a second on crossing the starting line, and that's coming at it at 50 miles an hour.
Wow. And assess for the moment the Kiwis. Can you just give me your views?
They look good. We've been really impressed. They're sailing the boats. You know, they came out of the blocks earlier than us in the build program. They decided to design and build very quickly. We put 3 months more time into our design, so we were a little bit behind them. We've been watching them really closely. We're going to have a great match against them. They're going to be good.
Yeah.
We screwed up. We made a class of boat. One of the briefs for the design of the boat, the rule was to make a boat that was challenging to sail for the sailors, and we may have overachieved in that area because it is definitely one of the most challenging boats. I don't know, Matty, I think you'd agree, but it's one of the most challenging boats to sail that I've ever seen. And unfortunately, the Kiwis are a very, very good sailing team. They're really great sailors, every single one of them, and that's their biggest strength, I think, is that they're probably the best sailing team out there, really competitive with ours. And that is a good battle between the two teams, but the boat's challenging to sail and they're great sailors.
So there's a rhetorical question I didn't get to, and we'll just leave it open, which was, after Oracle Team USA wins again, when will the next America's Cup race be back in San Francisco? So we'll just leave that one open for now. And with our thanks, Stan, Matt, Ian, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks,
Stan.
You've been listening to America's Cup Comes to San Francisco, Technology Under Sail. The program was recorded at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View on August 27, 2013. The panelists included Stan Honey, Director of Technology for the America's Cup Event Authority, Matt Mason, Grinder for Oracle Team USA, and Ian Burns, Design Team Member for Oracle Team USA. The moderator was John Holler, President and CEO of the Computer History Museum. The recording engineer was Jim Bennett. The technical supervisor was Monte Carlos. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.